We will go on the record and come to order. The commission is hereby convened in open session on Wednesday, November 9th, 2016, to consider the matter entitled Secretary of Labor versus CONSOL Pennsylvania Coal Company, LLC, docket number PEN 2013-385. Present are myself, Chairman Jordan, Commissioner Young, Commissioner Cohen, and Commissioner Alton. We'll start with an overview of the case presented by Boober Mukherjee. Good afternoon, Boober.
Good afternoon, Chairman and Commissioners. This matter involves a single docket, PEN 2013-385. The issues presented are whether the judge erred in finding high negligence, unwarrantable failure, S&S, and high likelihood of fatal injury with regard to a citation and order issued because of high accumulations of water in bleeder entries. CONSOL Pennsylvania Coal Company operates the Enlow Fork Mine, a large underground coal mine in western Pennsylvania. The mine is divided into numerous districts of longwall panels, identified by letter and subdivided by the number assigned to each such panel within that district. Each longwall panel runs east to west for approximately 2 miles, while the longwall face is approximately 1,000 feet across. The E-District bleeder system ventilates the mined out E-15 to E-22 longwall panels and must be examined weekly. During a bleeder exam, an examiner would check the ventilation as well as water accumulations, which hinder safe passage through the bleeder. Historically, most of the water which accumulated in the bleeder system was clear, though it could be cloudy, orange, and murky from magnetite and sulfur. The operator's ventilation plan permitted a system of 18 to 23 air pumps to reroute water accumulations in the bleeders. These air pumps dumped water into a sump, which was 12 to 13 feet deep, and two discharge lines transferred water from the sump to an underground retaining pool. The operator also had a backup surface sump pump, which was not included in the ventilation plan. The sump pump was only used during emergencies, such as when air pumps malfunctioned or there was too much water for the air pumps to handle. Originally, the sump pump would need to be manually activated, but a bubbler system was later installed that automatically activated the pump when water in the sump reached 22 inches. The sump pump transferred the water to 3 outdoor tanks. On November 20, 2012, MSHA Inspector Walter Young cited the operator for accumulations of water in this E-bleeder district. In certain areas, the depth of the water exceeded 36 inches. The water was dark and murky and contained various tripping hazards. The inspector designated the violation as significant and substantial and reasonably likely to result in lost workdays and restricted duty, and a result of low negligence. On December 10, 2012, Inspector Young again cited the operator for accumulations of water in the E-bleeder district. The depth of the water exceeded 24 inches in certain areas. The inspector designated the violation as significant and substantial, reasonably likely to result in lost workdays and or restricted duty, and a result of moderate negligence. After the citation on December 10, 2012, additional exams were conducted by the examiners and pump men. The judge also found that the operator installed a monitoring system allowing the operator to view the bubbler system on computer screens so examiners would not have to go to the sump pump. The monitor showed air pressure in the bubbler rather than inches of water in the bleeders. The screens showed a visual alarm when the sump pump was activated or when the surface tanks were full. However, the judge found that it wasn't clear whether this system was installed before the exams at issue, conducted on February 5, 2013. Prior to February 5, 2013, there was a power outage in the mine on February 1, 2013, and the surface pump also malfunctioned. In the early morning hours of February 5, 2013, sometime before 4 a.m., Dan Stalnaker, a certified examiner, entered the E-15 side of the bleeder district. He encountered a high level of water at the E-15 sump, but did not retreat. The water contained debris, gridlocks, and pieces of wood, but was otherwise relatively clear. Next, Dalmaker tried to travel through a mandal, which was 3 feet high. However, water poured into his waders when he bent over, presumably while trying to pass through the doorway, resulting in his methane detector becoming wet. Stalnaker then left the Bleeder District and informed ship foreman Robert Price at around 4 to 4:30 a.m. that he could not complete the ventilation exam because of his wet detector. Subsequent to Stalnaker's exam, another employee bypassed the bubbler on the sump pump, and the surface pump began functioning properly at around 5:05 a.m. on February 5, 2013. After speaking with Stalnaker, Price instructed another employee, Kevin Saunders, to complete the Bleeder exam, starting from the opposite direction. Price gave Saunders Stalnaker's notes. Saunders entered the E22 side of the Bleeder district between 4:30 a.m. and 10 a.m. Saunders retreated at 10 a.m. prior to finishing the exam upon encountering water that was waist high near the E15 sump area. Stalnaker and Saunders combined to inspect all but two of the evaluation points in the E Bleeder district. Stalnaker noted in the record book that he had conducted an exam, but did not fill out portions of the record book relating to places he was unable to examine. A foreman, Mike Giovanelli, countersigned the record book. While Giovanelli did not note the existence of the hazard in the record book, he did note it in the foreman's book. At approximately 10 a.m. on February 5, 2013, a Section 103G complaint regarding water accumulation in the E District Bleeders was filed with MSHA. Subsequently, sometime after 11:30 a.m., MSHA Inspector William Gross began to inspect the E District Bleeder system. Gross observed water ranging from 12 inches to 42 inches in depth and observed that the water in some areas was murky and obscured the walkway. He also noted that the area near the E15 sump was completely flooded. After returning to the MSHA office, Gross was reprimanded by the district manager for traveling in the accumulations of water. Gross exited the mine between 8:30 and 9 p.m. MSHA Inspector Walter Young, who had previously cited this Bleeder district in 2012, arrived at the mine at 9 p.m. on February 5, 2013. Inspector Young's policy was to only cite the Bleeder for hazardous accumulations of water when the water went over his 18-inch boots, when the water extended over a large area, when the water was discolored, or when the water contained tripping hazards. After Young arrived at the mine, Gross gave Young his notes and left the mine at 11 p.m. At around 11 p.m., Inspector Young spoke to Stalnaker and Saunders about their exams. Inspector Young then entered the mine at about 2 a.m. on February 6, 2013, and walked the perimeter of the E District Bleeder system. Young checked the mandor Stalnaker had used on February 5, 2013, and found that the water was 2 feet deep, even though the pump had been running for 20 hours by this time. Young believed that the water accumulation was caused by a failure to check the air pumps after a 12-hour power outage on February 1st. After completing his inspection, Inspector Young issued citation number 7024068 and order number 7024069 to the operator. Citation number 7024068 was issued under Section 104(d)(1) of the Mine Act for a violation of 30 CFR Section 75.370A1 because the operator failed to comply with its approved mine ventilation plan. Specifically, Inspector Young found that the bleeders were not maintained for safe travel because there were accumulations of water from 12 to 42 inches in depth for a total distance of 2,250 feet in the E tailgate to E21 panel bleeder district, and because the mine flow in this area can be irregular, contains rib sloughage, and other various tripping hazards. Order number 7024069 was issued under Section 104(d)(1) of the Act for a violation of 30 CFR Section 75.364H because the operator's employees signed the record book, but, despite knowing of the water accumulations, failed to note the hazard in the book. The inspector designated citation number 7024068 and order number 7024069 as a result of the operator's high negligence and unwarrantable failure to comply with the cited standard. The inspector also designated these violations as significant and substantial and highly likely to cause fatal injury. I can now take any questions you may have.
Thanks, Trooper. Are there any questions at this time? All right. I understand, Commissioner Althon, you've agreed to lead off our discussion. And I think that... we'll discuss the one citation at a time. Yeah, I guess the safe access first.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chairman Jordan. And Drupa, thank you for your memo and for your presentation. It's very useful to us. And I have your scorecard here, which I'll try and go down. First, we consider the issue of negligence. This is very interesting to me, and I'm sort of having evolving thoughts on negligence. I've always been troubled by the notion of mitigation of negligence, because it just somehow almost doesn't compute to me, like you're either negligent or you're not. And if mitigation was thought of responding to a standard of care by doing things intended to prevent the adverse activity, in that sense I could understand it. But there's a further complication in that we've told the commission judges they don't have to follow Part 100, and we've defined a standard of negligence essentially in Brody by saying, in this respect, the commission is recognized that the gravamen of high negligence is that it, quote, suggests an aggravated lack of care that is more than ordinary negligence, close quote. On remand, the judge will need to examine the two violations and determine the degree of negligence on the part of the operator that led to the violations. The judge must consider the actions that a reasonably prudent operator would or would not have taken under the circumstances presented that are relevant to an operator's obligation to comply with the ventilation plan provisions in question, close quote. That quote, which I completely agree with, seems to not include a notion of mitigation, as it were. It's just a sort of normal negligence definition. Negligence can be low. Normal negligence can you consider ordinary negligence, but you can have low negligence or high negligence within the range of negligence. Right now, the judges, we sort of say the judges can use Part 100, but they're not bound to use it. I think it puts the judges in a little bit of a like quandary as to, well, what are we supposed to do? Should we use those definitions or not? And if they do, how do they apply? And also, I just from a negligence standpoint tend to think that, as I say, that the negligence you bring to an act, it seems to me, is completed when the violation occurs. Mm-hmm. Your negligence doesn't get less because of something you do after the violation. So if I have an automobile accident and a driver seriously injured due to my negligence, the fact that I run over, provide assistance, and call an ambulance doesn't do anything to my negligence in causing the accident. So the actions of an operator to sort of immediately attempt to abate a violation doesn't seem to me to affect their degree of negligence. But we've always recognized the notion of immediate action somehow attenuates the negligence. I was looking back at the statute, probably should do that occasionally, and we have S&S, we have violations, we have S&S, we have unwarrantable failures, and then penalties. It seems to me negligence goes primarily to, of course, unwarrantable failure is a negligence concept. But negligence in its pure sense seems to go more to the penalty aspect. And when I look at the penalty provisions, it says, in assessing civil monetary penalties, the commission shall consider the operator's history of previous violations, the appropriateness of such penalty to the size of the business of the operator charged, whether the operator was negligent, the effect on the operator's ability to continue in business, the gravity of the violation, and the demonstrated good faith of the person charged in attempting to achieve rapid compliance after notification of a violation. Now, if we took after notification of a violation to mean after they know of the violation, the post-violation actions of the operator could count against the penalty in terms of that penalty criterion. And it actually seems to me to make more sense to view it that way than to view it as attenuating the negligence itself. So, for example, in this case, I think after the operator got the two citations, particularly the one on December 10, it was put on notice that he needed to do more to keep the water from accumulating. Their standard of care went up because they knew their efforts weren't sufficient. they did some things, and the question is, are those things they did actions that a reasonably prudent operator would have taken under the circumstances to prevent a violation of the ventilation plan? If they were all that, then there was no negligence. If they were not all that, then there was negligence of some degree. And then I tend to look at everything that happens after. I mean, I don't think this is our classic way of looking at it. After the violation was found, I look at it sort of going to either this last, you know, rapidly trying to fix it. Oh, we see we've got a problem, we're rapidly trying to fix it. And then the penalty, they should get some benefit of that. But it doesn't attenuate their negligence. So this is just an observation in a sense, because I'd remand the case for a determination of negligence in light of what I consider the judge's failure to apply either under Part 100 or our standard, if you will. See, I hate to say it that way because it shouldn't be two standards there, but to properly apply the negligence rules, I think it's fair in looking at the penalty to look at the overall circumstances, what they did afterwards and so forth, perhaps, and like the people went into the sound maker went into the water. But I don't think that really goes to whether they were negligent in letting the water accumulate. It should be a different violation, but it seems to me it's something different. In any event, the judge's decision that, you know, the failure of your acts to prevent the violation mean that there can be no mitigation in the way that the Part 100 contemplates it seems to be to be wrong, and I would send it back for the judge to look at negligence.
To clarify, would I be correct in saying you would be vacating the judge's determination of the high negligence and remanding it to the judge to reconsider the negligence aspect in determining the penalty, penalty?
I wouldn't want to limit a judge on remand. I know it'll be a different judge from determining the level of negligence based upon the record. So you say vacating the high negligence if the new judge found reason to find it high negligence.
Did Judge Horner leave?
Yeah, she's gone. She's retired.
Yeah, she's retired.
Oh, she
yeah, she's retired. So, in other words, I don't want to hamstring a judge under decision because I think she applied the wrong standard. I mean, I don't know. In other words, and very honestly, I think the attorney yesterday rightly thought it was a trick question when I asked him, like, so shouldn't we only count what happens to, because he thought, oh, you're reading mitigation out of it, man. You're taking away my major defense. Well, that's true if we look at it under Part 100 thing. That acts of that have classically been thought of as mitigation. I mean, I'd let the judge look at the whole case again and make a negligence determination under our standard of negligence, which is...
The
success of their... The failure alone established high negligence.
That failure alone?
In other words, the failure of it, them to prevent the water from coming up, establishes as high negligence. Did she say that to you?
No, I thought it was the exposure, the fact that
And the exposure, to me, is irrelevant to negligence.
Right.
Just as in her example of a roof control plan, a miner walking out under unsupported roof has nothing to do with whether you violated your roof control plan. And so the fact that miners walked out into this water has nothing to do with the negligence of allowing the water to be there in the first place.
Okay. Yeah, I know. We've talked about that. All right. Let's keep going.
We'll listen to everybody else.
Yeah, I just was trying.
All right. It'd be good if we don't want just to go on too long. Some of us were up late last night. Unwarrantable failure. I think I'd reverse that because she clearly got, I mean, I'll later say when I get down there, she clearly got the degree of danger wrong. I just don't see any sense to a notion that there was a high likelihood of fatalities. And I think she got obviousness wrong because she said obvious that, well, when they got there and looked at it, it was obviously deep water. Well, but obviousness to me in an unwarranted failure context means that it was obvious and you didn't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. The coal's been there for a shift and you didn't do it. It was obvious there was a violation. As soon as they saw this, they started working on it. So I'd be inclined to just vacate the unwarrantable failure finding.
Maybe vacate and remand or reverse?
Just reverse. Oh. Just reverse it. I know some may want to remand it. That's fine. I just by myself would reverse it. I'd find it S&S because it's clear that the hazard at which the ventilation plan was directed did occur, when just reasonably likely or whatever likely to occur. To me, there was a reasonably likelihood of a reasonably serious injury. On the gravity, let's say, for the separate gravity separate apart from S&S, I just don't find any support in the record that this violation was highly likely to result in a fatality. Searching the records of American coal mining, never been a miner who hit his head and drowned in a bleeder. You can walk up to 18 inches deep without it even being a hazard. I don't see how an extra 6 inches all of a sudden makes you highly likely to die. Perhaps there's some theory that that's true, but they didn't put that in the record. Now, in terms of, what should we do on gravity, you guys know this reverse vacate stuff better than I do. I would reverse your finding of highly likelihood to be fatal and remand for determination, I guess because I'd be remanding on negligence, just remand for determination. I myself would, if I was making it, would probably say lost work days. And I know that some of us may think gravity should be fit in sort of the same, don't have to obey the gravity pigeonholes of Part 100 any more than the negligence pigeonhole. So I'd be willing to listen to that. I think that does it.
Okay.
On the scorecard.
Thanks. Thanks, Commissioner Alton.
High likelihood, I said
no. Commissioner Cohen?
Thank you. And thank you, Druba, for the memo and for sitting down with me and going through those maps. That was very helpful. On S&S, I would affirm the judge. Well, you said you'd affirm too?
Yeah.
Okay.
It met the standard of Matthews and Newtown.
Yeah, I'm going to speak to that a little bit. I disagree with Consol that the hazard did not implicate the primary purpose of the standard, which was one of their arguments there. I think that argument goes to whether there was a violation, not whether it was S&S. The purpose of Section 75.370 is to control methane and respirable dust through the creation of an adherence to a ventilation plan. The determination of adequate ventilation involves a system of regular examinations on a daily and weekly basis. The examinations presuppose that the examiners will be able to travel to the places where the examinations must be conducted. Thus, the Enlow Fork Mine's ventilation plan requires that safe travel in the bleeders not be prevented by accumulations of water. If this provision of the ventilation plan is violated, as it was here, then an SDS analysis may be applied. Clearly, there was a violation, first step of Matthews. Second step of Matthews, the hazard was that the water in the travelways would cause examiners to slip or trip and fall. I think that this was both at least somewhat likely and reasonably likely.
Total agreement.
The third step, was it reasonably likely to cause injury? Yes, the judge explained that well. Fourth step, was it likely to be a serious injury? Again, yes, the judge explained it. Consol argues that the lack of injury in the past is irrelevant. Oh, no. I got to follow a somewhat hastily scrawled outline here. Up late, as you said, Bill. With regard to Consal's arguments, I don't think that they're valid. The lack of injury in the past is irrelevant. The exercise of caution is not relevant, and I think it's questionable if you, given that Mr. Stalnaker put on the waders and went into the water, does not seem to be an exercise of caution. And the abatement efforts are not relevant to this. We have here, on February 5th, an examiner carrying a great deal of equipment. It's interesting, Mr. Green talked about how much they had to carry when they were doing these exams. And he was walking alone in very rough conditions. I would note parenthetically that when I was representing former coal miners, if they had ever done any examinations of bleeders, they would talk about what horrendous work that was, difficult work. So I would affirm the judge on that. As to gravity, first, it's important to note to look closely at the judge's actual analysis of the inspector marking the citation as highly likely to result in fatal injury. I think Judge Harner lumped this in with the S&S analysis, and she went over 6 pages on this. And her actual conclusion was that a fatal injury was reasonably likely. That's what the analysis was. She spoke in terms of reasonably likely, not highly likely. And then at the end, she says in one sentence, this is 37 Femschrick at 1647, it was highly likely, so I affirm. There's nothing more there. I don't think we need to get into analysis of whether substantial evidence supported or didn't support highly likely. I think, for one thing, that would kind of require us to make a definition of highly likely, and I don't want to do that. I think that this is very, very similar to what we've looked at in terms of the Part 100 negligence standards. The highly likely is part of a gradation created by Table 11 of Section 3E of Part 100 for the purpose of determining penalty points. And as I said in a separate opinion in Hidden Splendor, I think it's very reasonable for the Secretary to create those kinds of gradations and categorizations for the purpose of affording inspectors a way to mark an enormous number of decisions that they must make in issuing citations and orders. They have to have some way to do this which is going to correlate with somebody else in the Office of Assessments setting a penalty for it. And so they've set up a bunch of gradations, including reasonably likely, highly likely, and it occurred, just like they set up a bunch of gradations for negligence. The gradations, as we said in Brody, are not binding on the commission. And what the commission and its judges are bound to do is to apply Section 110I. One of the factors in Section 110I is the gravity of the violation. So judges have to look at the gravity of violation just as they have to look at the negligence of the violation. And I think that what we should be saying here in this case is that judges should look at gravity in a holistic way, similar to what we've said with negligence. I don't have a definition of that, you know, as we sit here today. But I think we can come up with one. And I think that here the judge's analysis of gravity was sufficient and her conclusion was supported by substantial evidence. I would not worry about the changing to lost work days from fatal. But, you know, we could talk about that if we have to. But I really think that we should avoid getting into whether it was highly likely or reasonably likely. The judge's real finding is reasonably likely. And that's affirmable, and we should affirm it. Now, with regard to negligence, I think this is the most difficult issue in the case, and my views on it are pretty tentative. The threshold question, I think, is whether the actions of Mr. Stalnaker and Mr. Saunders in causing themselves to be exposed to the hazard and whether the action of Mr. Price in directing Mr. Saunders to continue the examination, whether any of that's relevant or not. And Commissioner Alton spoke yesterday and suggested that none of that is relevant to a determination of negligence. And I was kind of in agreement with that. And I think it's tempting to say it's not relevant, but then I thought of this. The standard that we're dealing with is based on a ventilation plan, and the standard is to keep a safe travel way in the bleeders, preserve a safe travel way. And that, I think, includes, if you're looking at negligence, both the actions of the operator in maintaining the travel way and keeping water out of the travel way, and the actions of the operator's agents in how they deal with water once they encounter it. And if that's correct, and that's what I'm not totally convinced of, but if that's correct, then we should be looking, as the judge did, at both the actions of the individuals and what Consol did. Now, Consol, in terms of dealing with the keeping the water out of the bleeder, did. Now, Consol makes a couple of arguments that I reject. First, Consol argues that the judge created an analytic system under which any effort at mitigation must be successful in order to be considered as mitigation. That was in the brief. That was the argument Mr. McHugh made yesterday. And I don't think the judge did that. I think what she said was that the system was wholly inadequate to keep water out of the bleeder, and that because Stalnaker and Saunders traveled into the water, any efforts to mitigate, so I recognize that there were mitigates, efforts, but any efforts to mitigate were in vain. And she used that phrase on page 35 of the opinion, of the decision. So I don't think she was making a legal classification or a legal analysis of mitigation as being necessarily successful. It has to be, the argument, it's all right. It has to be successful if we're going to consider it as mitigation. I don't think she did that. What she was doing was to make a factual determination that the actions of Stalnaker and Saunders nullified Consol's efforts. And that's what we should be looking at, not this generic question that Consol raised, but which is not really, I don't think, presented by the record. So, second, the other problem I have with Consol's argument is that the judge was bound by the Part 100 definition of high negligence, and that any mitigation nullifies high negligence. And we have rejected that in Brody, and I've discussed that in the Hidden Splendor opinion that I wrote. I think we're clear that that should be a holistic analysis. Now, I think what happened here, what may have happened here, is that Judge Harner got hung up on the Part 100 definitions. And she may have felt that in order to find high negligence, which she believed had occurred, in order to find high negligence, she had to reject all claims of mitigation. And so she went out of her way to reject mitigation in terms of whether it was mitigating or not, because she had to determine if there was any mitigation at all under the Part 100 regulations, then it's not high negligence. You know, that's the hang-up with using that definition. And I really think we should tell judges not to use it. Now, in looking at Consol's claims of mitigation, I think the judge erred in a couple of ways. One was that she found that all the mitigation efforts were nullified by the actions of Stalnaker and Saunders and Price, because they, whatever the situation was, she kind of said, these miners, these examiners were exposed to high water. So nothing mattered by way of mitigation. I don't think that's correct. I think we have to actually consider what they did. Secondly, I don't think she gave sufficient consideration to the fact that as one of the efforts they made after the December 10th citation, If I'm reading the record correctly.
Watch out, Bob.
I guess not.
What on earth?
Somebody leaned against the switch.
We've been hacked. Darn you, Russians.
Where's that switch?
Okay. I look like a guillotine.
I know. Coming in. All right.
At least it was taken out both the Republican and Democrat.
and given President Trump more appointed.
We wouldn't have had a quorum.
That's true.
That's right. We just stop until President Trump takes
it. It'd be a cliffhanger case.
One of the things that's, if I'm understanding the record correctly, one of the things that Consol did was to have its examiners check the bleeders more frequently than once a week. The secretary argued in his brief that they didn't do anything to actually check what was going on in the bleeders. They were checking what the remote control, you know, mechanisms were saying about how much water was coming out of the sump pump and, you know, stuff like that. But I think they did, if I'm right about this, they did have people checking more frequently than once a week as to what was actually going on at the bleeders. Mr. Green testified that after the power outage on February 1st and before Stalnaker's examination on February 5th, he walked the bleeders several times and did not see excessive water. And the judge credited that testimony. So it seems to me that that is, should be considered in the consideration of mitigation. I'm going to suggest that the case be remanded. I'm not, you know, saying what is the ultimate result. But that is something to be considered in terms of mitigation. Now let's look at the actions of Stalnaker and Saunders and Price. And the first thing I would say here is that I reject the assertion that Price ordered Saunders to walk through water to complete the examination. Again, if I'm understanding the record correctly, and I'm subject to being checked on this, what Price told Saunders was to go in and try to complete the examination, but to turn back if necessary. He was not ordering Saunders to go into the water. And you know, I think the secretary argued, yeah, but he apologized to Saunders. Well, I think he apologized for Saunders for making him do a really nasty piece of work of going into the bleachers. It's they have an obligation to complete the weekly examination and to make sure that everything is right at the evaluation points. And it seems that that's what Price was trying to do there. He was trying to complete the weekly examination. If Saunders could come around the other way and get through and complete the weekly examination, that was good. And enhance safety. But what Stalnaker, and as to what Stalnaker and Saunders actually did, I don't accept Consall's characterization of them as retreating as soon as they came upon water. It doesn't seem to me that that happened. Stalnaker in particular put on waders, which is contrary to Consall's policy and contrary to Pennsylvania state law. And he went in, he put on the waders so he could go into water which presented a hazard. That was a conscious decision on his part. We in the midst of writing a decision on a case where a foreman did something that at least some of us feel was reflexive action, and is that unwarrantable failure? Whether that one was reflexive or not, what Mr. Stalnaker did was not reflexive. Very conscious to find there were waders that were ready to be found there for some reason, and he went and put them on and went into the water and did not retreat until his multi-gas detector got wet, which, if I'm understanding things correctly, would make it impossible for him to take the measurements he was trying to take at the evaluation points. So he didn't turn back because the water was high. He turned back because he couldn't have done what he needed to do when he got through the water into the evaluation points. So I don't think it's, well, he retreated. Well, no, not because of the water. And with Saunders, he went into water which was waist high. And I'd like to say here that I appreciate, I'm grateful, Mr. McHugh yesterday, who during the oral argument when I was trying to determine what the depth of the water was that Saunders went into, and the Secretary's counsel didn't know, he came back and said, well, it was waist high. I'll acknowledge that. You know, I think that's good lawyering. That's honest lawyering. And we should be respectful of that. And okay. So, Saunders went into waist high water. I don't think that's a quick retreat either. He had to get there. So, on the question of negligence, I would vacate and remand the judge's negligence determinations, and I would say that on remand, she should first approach the issue of negligence holistically without relying on without regard for the Part 100 definition. Second, she should consider that Consall's efforts of mitigation are not 100% nullified by the actions of Stalnaker and Saunders, or Price. Third, she should consider the mitigation efforts that Consall made. She can find, as she did in her decision, that Consall's mechanical system was wholly inadequate. She said, quote, wholly inadequate to the challenge of keeping water out of the bleeder. I think that's probably a defensible finding, which is supported by substantial evidence. And I'm not particularly impressed with many of the things that Consall argued about, the mechanical breakdown of the bubbler system on the sump pump. I don't think is a mitigating circumstance. That was an old system, they acknowledged, and there were a lot of mechanical things that were going wrong out there. But I think that having an examiner actually go in more frequently than once a week should be considered potentially as mitigating. Fourth, she should consider the actions of Stalnaker and Saunders in entering the water, but not of Price, as part of the, what she considers. And fifth, she has to weigh it all together, like judges do when they weigh together all of the unwarrantable failure factors. So I would remand and have her do that. As to unwarrantable failure, the judge had a four-page analysis of the IO coal factors, which was very thorough. My reaction to it was that it was supported by substantial evidence, but I want to rethink that in terms of some of the things that Commissioner Alton just said. And I think we should probably determine whether that analysis, as far as it went, was supported by substantial evidence. But I think that the unwarrantable failure determination should be remanded because the negligence issue should be reexamined. So that's where I come out on unwarrantable. I think that's everything.
Okay. Commissioner Young.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you, Drew, for preparing this case for our consideration and your management of the record and your memo was very helpful. I asked a dumb question yesterday at oral argument about this ventilation plan violation and the condition with the water not being cited as an imminent danger, not likely to, and did not generate any more light than was previously presented during the hearing on the case. But there was a smart question there, and I think when you start wading into, pardon the intentional pun, the question of the high likelihood of a fatal injury in this case, if that's really the case factually, why was this not a flagrant? And the answer for me is that it's not that way factually. It's just not. When you start talking about a high likelihood of something, you're talking about a probability. If someone were to tell you you're highly likely to encounter a person eating tiger in the hallway, you're not leaving this room. It's just, people understand what that means as a lay person. Inspectors need to understand that too. And these are checklist items that are developed to allow a kind of a sketch that needs to be filled in with further development of the facts if one of these citations or orders is challenged. And so when the inspector marks something as highly likely to lead to a fatal injury, it's subject to being challenged and to having the burden on the secretary to prove that that's so where it's relevant. I would tend to agree maybe with Commissioner Cohen that it's not relevant in a large number of cases, except as Commissioner Alton noted, perhaps for the penalty. But if the allegation is made and the judge decides that it's necessary to decide whether something's highly likely to lead to a fatal, I think the facts would naturally lead one of the ALJs to that analysis and that conclusion, and the judge would act accordingly. But I would agree with Commissioner Cohen that I don't think it serves our judicial and adjudicatory function very well to go into or be somehow constrained by the way the secretary has chosen to phrase things in administrative documents that he uses to conduct inspections. The enforcement and inspection function are different from the adjudicatory function, and I agree with Commissioner Cohen on how these things ought to be looked at and regulated. So the problem that I have is that I think that once you have convinced yourself as a judge that something is highly likely to result in a fatal injury, what that does, when you're looking properly at the negligence standard, as Commissioner Cohen has suggested, is it amps up the burden of proof. I mean, pardon me, the duty of care. And you all know when you're watching TV, the commercial comes on, and it's just so jarringly loud. It's just so annoyingly loud. But the fact is that they don't raise the volume because there's the FCC limits and regulates your ability to do that as a broadcaster. What happens is they compress everything at a certain volume level that's really loud. And if everything's really loud, nothing's going to stand out. Everything's just this level of intense attention-seeking noise. And you can't really have that in a mind. You have to have some discernment between things that are vital and must be attended to immediately because they present a clear and present danger to the health and safety of minors, and things that are violations that should be fixed and must be fixed with reasonable promptness, but are less likely to immediately injure anybody. And then you have everything in between, including things that are going to meet the Matthews criteria, which I would agree in this case, this violation is S&S and meets the Matthews criteria. So on the negligence, I was inclined to remand this, and I think I would like to go along with Commissioner Cohen's formulation of what we might suggest to the judge on remand. I could go either way, though, because I don't think that, I think that once you pull out the likelihood of a fatal injury, you look at what the operator did in this case. They did a lot. It wasn't like this wasn't something where this was a problem that was being ignored, but it was a persistent problem that was resistant to being addressed by an engineering solution that the operator selected. But I still think that it's worth remanding, not only because there's a reasonable question about whether the engineering solution selected was the right one for the situation, and you also have the circumstances that I think I hadn't really considered the way Commissioner Cohen had expressed them. Bring into focus the actions of the miners in the water that they encountered. If people aren't going to be traveling in the bleeders much or often, or they don't need to access an area to reach the BEPs, maybe water in the bleeders is not such a significant problem. And maybe there's a line there somewhere where the amount of water might be tolerable under the circumstances. The quality of the water might come into effect. But I think that it is relevant in that sense. So I'm inclined to remand on the negligence. On the unwarrantable failure, this is another one that I could go either way on. This, to me, this, me personally, if I were the finder of fact, this isn't the type of case where I would find an unwarrantable failure, because I don't see an operator not taking actions. Again, they had a series of problems, and I don't know that it rises to that level of aggravated conduct in the face of those problems. But at the same time, it's hard for me to say that a finder of fact looking at the record wouldn't be able to draw that conclusion, and that it would necessarily have to compel only one conclusion, which is that this is not an unwarrantable failure. But it's close for me. And I could go either way on that question. I'm interested to hear what the chairman thinks about that. I've already said it's S&S. In terms of the high likelihood and the fatal, I've already said that I would reverse on those, because I don't believe the record could support that conclusion. But I agree with Commissioner Cohen that what we may want to do is to remind our judges not to get distracted by the way evidence is presented on documents that MSHA prepares for one purpose, and not to have them knock them off of their focus in accomplishing a different purpose, which is to take into account not only the things that the inspector perceives during the inspection, which is what governs is what is written on the form, informed also by the inspector's experience, and the history that he's aware of in the mine, et cetera. So, you know, everything else comes in at the trial. In this case, I don't think it was, you know, especially relevant. It's not necessary to the secretary's case to establish a high likelihood of a fatal injury. And since it's going to be remanded for at least some of the issues, it's going to have to be remanded for the penalty. To the extent it's relevant for the penalty, I don't see the evidence here supporting it. But, you know, that's my position on that, is that I would reverse. I on the issue of mitigation, this is a funny thing for me, I guess. I guess I have a different view of mitigation and aggravation in this context. It's like you were talking about, if you're driving the car, and you know, you, let's say you're cited for driving erratically and you hit somebody. If you were texting and you hit somebody, that's aggravation. If you were under attack from a couple of wasps or something, that might be mitigation. So, you know, I look at mitigation not just as really abatement type efforts that they might have undertaken, or things that they might have done once they discovered that there was a violation, but also the things that they were doing and the problems that they were encountering, and whether that excused or explained the absence of a solution sufficiently to satisfy the trier of fact. So that, you know, that's how I tended to view that issue. Thank you.
Can I quickly say something? Because I don't disagree with that. I think a mitigation in that sense is part of the a reasonable prudent person under the same or similar circumstances. You got a bee sting in your nose, that's one set of circumstances. You're texting, that's a different set of circumstances. That, I think we're on the same wavelength there.
I agree.
All right. Well, I agree with a lot of what's been said here. I'm going to try and step back and sort of try and paraphrase it or summarize it in a way that we can think about how, clarify exactly where we are on certain issues and what an opinion would look like, because I feel like from what the discussion here, it's a little difficult for me to envision what we would be saying to a judge. I mean, at bottom, nobody's affirming the decision as it stands, so nobody's voted aye, including myself.
Except on the S&S.
Right, but I mean, there's portions that are being affirmed.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So the decision is not being affirmed. It's going back to a judge. And so another judge is going to look at it. They are going to understand that they have to reassess a penalty, I think, from what has been said here. And that probably, I mean, my view of this is, my understanding coming into here, my feeling was the judge would be being told why the penalty has to be reassessed. I agree with Commissioner Cohen, I'll explain later. It's not, I didn't envision myself telling them, use it highly likely or this and that. That's irrelevant to me. It's just reassess the penalty. You have to take into account gravity and negligence and reassessing the penalty. And here's where you went wrong with your initial penalty. You can't, you know, you were too high in viewing the negligence or something like that. Or you could reach that same amount, but you analyzed it wrong or we're not sure. So I wanted to try and walk through it that way. So I'm looking at this opinion. There's the special findings that are attached to it of unwarrantable failure in S&S that are before us. We all would affirm the S&S designation. So that's the end of that. Regarding the unwarrantable designation, I'm a little unclear, actually, where we stand on that. I think like Commissioner Young, I mean, I see defects in the judge's upholding on the unwarrantable. And this would also, because unwarrantable is a negligence designation, it affects the negligence determination in the sense that the way I look at it is the unwarrantable designation, you find aggravated conduct, the commission has said, you know, is there an indifference, a reckless disregard, you know, a certain aspect that warrants the unwarrantable designation. And what I thought was happening here is that the judge, in looking, they had made efforts after the prior citations to hopefully increase their ability to keep the water level at bay in the bleeders. And so you're looking at those efforts, and really I saw the fact that the examiners walked through the water as relevant in the sense of an indication of whether those efforts were good faith. Because, you know, when somebody is being accused, the EMSH inspector goes in there, it's the third time he finds water. I mean, it's almost like a rebuttable presumption. It's like, you guys aren't, you know, giving a damn about this. You know, why am I coming back here 2 months later and finding all this water? You know, what's happened? And then they're saying, but look what we did. You know, we've had this guy underground who's green, was doing more inspections. We've built this monitoring system. And so then the question comes, that comes into play in assessing, well, maybe the existence of the water is not a result of an unwarrantable failure to comply. However, then the judge is, you know, looking over here and thinking, you know, that the fact that these people just waded through the water, does that not negate the efforts? I mean, I think she applied almost too much weight to it. It was as though once she saw they had proceeded through the water, she didn't really give much credence or weight to the steps they put in place, you know, their monitoring system and the additional things. She didn't really discuss them much. So I feel that taints her affirming of the unwarrantability designation. And I wasn't sure then, stepping back, whether the record would still allow, in which case I would remand it to a judge, you know, or vacate it and say, I think you went astray in the analysis of upholding the unwarrantable because you basically ignored their efforts once you focused on them walking through the water, and say, look at it. It can play a role in assessing whether there was a good faith effort, but it's not the total determinative factor. whether the opinion should direct that kind of approach, or whether, looking at the record here, we would say that even in light of those people walking through the water, even taking that into account, there's not enough there to uphold a warrantable, given that, given what they put into place. That, you know, they did make a good faith effort, and in which case I would reverse the unwarrantability finding. So I was kind of hoping to see, you know, like where my colleagues went on that, and I could, you know, lean toward either way. So then the other, the questions of then the negligence and the gravity, I mean, that really goes to then the penalty. And because in a sense, are we sending it back to a judge? Are we vacating and remanding and essentially saying, you can't come up with the same penalty. You know, it has to be lower because, in so many words,
right.
You know, in a generic way. It's like, and it's not like because we're saying it's reasonable likelihood of lost days versus highly. We're saying it's this versus this. It's just there was error in the way the penalty was assessed. You have to reassess it. Gravity, the record does not support a high negligence, like saying something like that. You know, your penalty was based on a finding of very high negligence, but we think that was an error, and so it has to be reassessed with consideration of a lower negligence without specifying, because I agree. I don't know why we'd be specifying. We don't apply the formula. And I can't see us here saying it's a high, you know, fatal, lost days. It's like, I mean, it has to go back, and the penalty has to be reassessed. The key information a judge needs on remand is, what am I allowed to, are there things I took into account that I shouldn't in the second time around, or how, you know. Drupa, can you remind me what the penalty was in this citation?
$14,000.
So essentially, it was a $14,000 penalty, which was based on a finding of high, unwarrantable failure, essentially equating to then high negligence and a very serious gravity. What are we telling that has to be different? I mean, I think we have to be clear. And I was listening to the discussion here. It was very interesting, but it got very esoteric at times. And I'm like, wait a minute. Do they need all that? I mean, they just need to know, can I find high negligence on remand? Or are you guys saying, no, the record would not? Can it be serious gravity? Or are you saying, no, it's not? You know, something
well,
less.
It's I think it could be serious gravity because it's an SNS violation. I mean, it's reasonably likely. You know, I mean, it's,
I agree. I would affirm, like in a sense, without, I don't know if I have to get into high likelihood of it. I feel that it is serious. Like the gravity to me is serious. Highly likelihood to be fatal. I mean, I know you're saying, well, it's fatal. Nobody's died. You know, you're not. I have to say, though, there's just a part of me, I'm not comfortable with reversing, and maybe it means I have to affirm, you know, the high likelihood designation.
I think we can fudge it. I don't think we have to get into it. I think we can say the judge found this was serious gravity. We agree.
I agree, because, you know, I just keep picturing, I know it's not required, but they're in there alone. There's no communication. And the thought of walking around and, you know, the waste of water with tripping hazards and everything, I can't bring myself to vacate, you know. And I don't have to find that it has to be highly likely to death versus lost work days, because that's not how we...
No, right, I agree.
That's not how we find gravity or assess a penalty. We just have to take gravity into account in assessing the penalty.
If you want to say that the judge properly found S&S and the facts supporting that, and then we say, drop a footnote and say, you know, don't get pigeonholed on these Part 100 descriptive terms, I'm okay with that. I mean...
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe we can. Well, what is the problem with the penalty? It's that the penalty was assessed based on a too high a negligence because she looked at the people, the two examiners walking through, and saw that as just...
But, Chairman, that's still... I'm not sure that any of you agree with me on this, and I listened carefully, and I think I understand what you're saying about them entering into the water having to do with negligence, and it just maybe I'm just always too literal, but the citation is that the operator failed to comply with their approved mine ventilation plan, in that the bleeders were not maintained for safe travel in the E tailgate D21 bleeder district. Close quote. That's the violation. That's what they were negligent in not doing. But we have to prove whether they were negligent or not. I guess there's something about me that says if Stahlnaker had not gone in the water, it wouldn't have made their actions any more or less negligent. And going into the water did not make their actions in failing to maintain the bleeder anymore. In other words, not going into the water wouldn't have made their actions in failing to maintain the bleeder for safe travel any less negligent. And going into the water doesn't make it any more negligent. That's what Bob and I were talking about. I mean,
it could. I guess I disagree with you there.
Well, I know.
It could in my mind, in the sense that, okay, there's water in the bleeders. You haven't maintained safe access. Okay, given. I now have to determine a penalty for you and a negligent. And I in doing that, the statute says I consider how negligent you were in that water.
If you're going to say
getting there,
that goes to gravity, though, doesn't it, rather than negligence? I agree, gravity. Going into the water may affect the gravity of the violation, but not the negligence.
I don't follow that.
I'm almost looking at it like one of those, like if you're in a neighborhood and you see a sign that says children at play, does that increase your duty to be more vigilant?
And it does.
So I'm looking at this as when you see that this is how the miners work and travel on these bleeders.
But that to me is...
Isn't that the exemplar?
When the December 10 citation is the sign being more vigilant. Not that after you've sped through the neighborhood and either you're texting and hit a dog, I wouldn't even say child, you hit a dog, or you were having a seizure and hit a dog, that affects your negligence. And so, but what you do after the accident, after you hit the dog, what do you just drive off, or that doesn't affect your negligence in having
doesn't
hit the
it?
Dog?
Like it, because you now say you, to me, I tried. We really tried to keep the water down.
Right.
You know, I'm sure we look what we did. It's not like we don't care. Here's what we did. So now I'm assessing what you did, and isn't it appropriate? Like I'm thinking, did you really try in good faith?
I understand what you're saying,
and they're coming over and saying they don't really care if people are in the
exactly.
water.
I understand that's what you're
marching
saying.
Through the
I understand
water.
That's what you're really? Saying is that they just don't care because look how they act.
Your argument is I think is convincing the other way. If you were trying a negligence case before a jury, and the driver hit the dog and then drove off, compared to what would happen if the driver stopped and then tried to give aid to the dog, the verdict would be enormously different. I can think of a case I had. It wasn't with the dog, but it was what the driver did after the accident made an enormous difference in the verdict. And
that's a damage situation. It's totally different than this situation. That's a damage situation.
You're going to have a damage.
It's not really damages, but I'm not sure. The funny thing is, Bob, I don't know if that's like a that's purely a negligence thing or if that's just psychology.
I mean, in other words,
that's the why being does instructed on
just explain to me why walking into that water made this any more or less negligent? Would our negligence finding be different if they hadn't gone in?
Because the requirement is to keep the travel way clear, and if they go in, as well as not have it as clear as it could be, I think that does affect.
I think it's another violation.
That's what I thought you were saying. I mean, I actually thought about this too. I questioned myself: would it support this violation in the sense of it's a separate time they went through the water, and maybe that itself was an unwarrantable development that over
if you have roof support and it's adequate, and the guy goes out from under it. there's no violation at all. It's a separate violation. They weren't negligent in their roof support. If you comply with your roof support plan and somebody walks under, out from under a supported roof, there's no violation. It's because the fact that somebody did something wrong doesn't make you any more or less negligent or compliant with your roof control plan.
Well,
and if you had one little, say you had a bolt 12 inches off the approved roof control plan and somebody walked under it, would that make that 12 inches like really negligent as opposed to just negligent?
Well, here's how I would look at it. You've got a roof bolt off or you've got a roof bolt missing. You violated your roof control plan. You're going to be assessed a penalty, and part of what enters into it is how negligent. And I understand what you're saying. Was I negligent in leaving out that roof bolt? But is it entirely inappropriate for me to consider the fact that in fixing that roof bolt, you told somebody, go in, don't worry about the canopy on the miner, just go in. Would you go in and just ram that roof bolt in the way it's supposed to be?
Well,
and they're exposed to danger while they're correcting it?
It seems to me
that's
what you're saying. What
we
you're saying
got
is
going that, here, and I, you
I
know,
understand what I, you're saying, and I have to think about it and appreciate it, is that you're saying, it seems to me, is that it sort of proves sort of more of our overall negligence. They're a negligent operator.
Exactly.
Because they do these things.
And I'm trying to figure out, I'm wondering, is that appropriate to take into account here? I mean, that's in assessing the penalty. I agree. You know, they let the water rise, and there was negligence.
I think it is, but that's the gravity part of the penalty.
Why is it gravity?
I just think it's part of the context of the violation that makes you evaluate the duty of care in light of how the bleeders were being traveled and what happened as an exemplar of what was necessary or what the examiners believed they should do in the situation, at least, and whether that's prudent. Because if the duty, the thing that grabbed me was Commissioner Cohen saying, here, look, the duty is to maintain these for safe travel. And if you don't have to walk through the water to take the readings, then it's not a problem. If it's a certain depth and it's not really hazardous or you've got a bridge or something, it's not a problem. But here, you know, the operator, in context, its agents are acting in a way that's a continuation of the demonstration that these were not safely maintained, because the miners at least felt compelled by something to make a decision to enter that water.
I mean, this is something
I understand
your emotion about it, and it's sort of the theoretical leisure, but I...
It's not emotion.
Yeah, it is emotion.
I took it. I know what you mean.
When you see whether a person, our standard is, did they do, after the December 10 citation, what a reasonably prudent operator would do to maintain a safe travelway.
Right. And then they come in and they say, here's what we did.
Here's what we did.
We beefed this up here.
But water,
we
but
we were good.
All right, but it didn't work. We violated it. Water got in there.
Right.
How does a guy walking into the water make those steps any more or less reasonably prudent?
I guess because, I mean, just good faith, it's sort of like what a reasonable operator, and I guess you're sitting there trying to assess that. And it came into this case because here you have these people walking in, exposing themselves, and the judge really, you know, that was sort of what turned her to sit, you know, she seemed
to face
it only on that. She's like, really? She said, I don't care what you did. I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, very nice you explained to me all the difference, but it's all for naught because these people were exposed, you know, over here to the hazard. I'm just trying to think about that. Like, well, do I tell her, and whatever judge gets it, a remand, you can't, this is irrelevant to your determination of a penalty. You're not allowed, you know, that shouldn't enter into
it. Well, I understand this is a bit of a departure, too, because Mr. McHugh was terrified at the thought that you'd stop there. Because he's counting on the mitigation of them, all the things that various commissioners, particularly Commissioner Cohn, pointed out as having diminished their negligence.
Right.
And I don't think that diminished their negligence with respect to keeping it travel way free and clear. I think it does bear on the last penalty, criterion, which is good faith efforts after you've got notification of the violation.
Let me put this out.
You don't have to convince me today.
Let me try one more. With all of the engineering things that they did or didn't do and all like that, one of the physical facts down there was that there was a set of waiters. Now, there were maybe three sets of waiters as of December 10th, but clearly there was one set of waiters on February 5th. Now, that's a physical fact on the ground that, you know, and Stalnaker knew where the waiters were, and he put them on. Doesn't that relate to the negligence in dealing with safe travel ways?
Can I make a suggestion?
Yeah.
If you were to write something up, like explaining your theory that Zhruba could share with us, and then we could consider it. Because, I mean, I think it's an intriguing theory.
I'd like to answer your question. Yes, you're right. It does. They're dealing with safe travel ways. That wasn't what they were accused of here. The violation is failing to maintain. If you're saying they are just really bad with these travel, they let people go in deep. All that may well be true, but that's not what you're charged with here. The violation is failing to maintain the safe travel ways. So the fact that
you're not agreeing. I thought I talked to you yesterday. We both agreed. The argument they were trying to make of, oh, this has to do with ventilation, so people walking.
Oh, no, that argument. That's foolish.
Yeah,
no, what I'm saying is their overall process of dealing with safe travel ways and whether they encouraged people to walk in wet water by leaving deep water, by leaving waders conveniently located and pull packets all around around the bleeder, you know, and here's your waiter money for the week, you know. Those may be terrible other violations, but they don't go to this violation, which is specifically not maintaining the bleeder in a manner safe for travel.
Well, but
they probably should be penalized up to wazoo for all those other things.
I know, but the trouble is, there's a violation. It doesn't go to the violation, essentially. But in a sense, then we have to consider what you're allowed to, you know, there's going to be a penalty assessed, and whether it was a result of aggravated conduct or, you know, an indifference, a reckless disregard for safe access. And I'm going back to my question to you. You said, well, I think it's relevant, but it's part of the gravity.
Well, I think.
Can you explain? I mean, I'm trying to,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah,
maybe.
I think.
Why is
the violation, we look at the negligence. And then because it's strict liability, even if there's no negligence, we look at a gravity.
Right.
So the gravity of allowing water to get to 42 inches may well be likelihood of a serious injury.
Yeah.
But that's the gravity determination, not the negligence determination. For example, we had a case where Judge IMSA cited and assessed a $50,000 penalty because the operator didn't exercise proper oversight of the contractor. And it was not a fatal injury, but it was, I think, a permanently disabling injury. IMSA cited $50,000. Judge Millick found no negligence and reduced the penalty to $500. He didn't do that because he didn't think it was a very grave situation. He did it because they weren't negligent. So negligence is not the same as gravity. This is a grave situation.
Oh, but, no, I agree, but not the same. You could be very negligent. It could be a very minor, not too much of a dangerous situation. But on the other hand, if you've been very negligent and you've been told like 50 times to clean up this housekeeping thing, I think, you know, you're very negligent. It could be unwarrantable. So I agree. Now here, but I'm not sure I'm following why it's part of the gravity. Here I look at it like it's weighing, coming into the negligence in terms of sort of an overall approach, because unwarrantable, negligence, you know, are you reckless disregard, do you care? And on the one hand, you're trying to argue to MSHA and the judge, we care, we really made a good faith effort, we put all these things, this is really the best.
I understand, I'll think about it. I understand,
okay,
but
think,
you're,
yeah.
I mean, I don't think we should be in the position of telling Inspector Young that he had to cite them for the waiters in addition, you know?
No, I don't think we should. I mean,
they have to make two violations out of this.
No, I think
well, I mean, I'd want to tell him what to do. We shouldn't tell him anything about what to do, but if they see two violations, they should cite them. I don't know. Maybe they shouldn't.
Did I miss something here? I know you mentioned the waiver.
I completely understand you, and I'm going to think about it very seriously, because I know what you were saying is, don't read this so narrowly. Read it to mean safe maintenance of the travelways in the sense of the operation of the bleeders. I understand that. And I'll just have to think whether I continue to stay by my little narrow-minded, strict, literal reading of these things, or broaden my horizons out to the scope of the other commissioners.
All right, we'll have to, I'm not sure what.
Mike, do you still want anything written?
If you want to advance the theory, I'd consider it. I mean, I'm not committing to it, but I think.
What is the theory?
The theory that the.
Is it the same what I've been saying?
The actions,
or something different than.
Yeah, basically.
I would agree with you.
Yeah.
You agree with me. Okay,
yeah.
Just checking. Theory.
On this, at least.
Okay.
I'd hope there's a way we could write this where
I
we
know.
Could all get on board.
That's actually what I was thinking, and that's why I had flexibility even on terms of, you know, the rulings and specifics. But
we have way more agreement than disagreement.
And I think
absolutely.
It has to be, in a way, kept simple, because the more you start going down little paths that are not really crucial to the decision, it gets...
Well, we would all... Remand on negligence? Is that your position also? I wasn't sure from my
perspective. It is, yeah, because I feel that the judge, I don't know how to phrase it, but, you know, gave too much weight to the fact that the I think, you know what I'm saying? It's like she sort of ignored their efforts because she went off totally
and
looked at...
And there was some disagreement among us about whether we're going to remand or reverse on unwarrantable. And I don't know that that's resolved. I think we all agreed to affirm on S&S, and we were kind of talking about dropping a footnote on this highly likely business and dealing with that way. And that would seem to be a solution to that.
Now, let me say, as long as we're trying to wrap this up, and I probably won't get this, I'm sure we can write around it, but on gravity, I do find, without saying that the Part 100 have to be followed, I do find sort of classifications of gravity somewhat more for a judge to do than just simply saying this was seriously grave. I mean, in other words, there's a big difference between, to me at least, a broken limb and a permanently disabling injury.
Right.
So I think having the judges distinguish between fatalities, permanently I think the Part 100, as far as what's reasonably likely to happen, make a lot of sense. You know, lost work days, permanently disabling, fatality. I don't think we have to pigeonhole like it, but I think those gradations do help assess how grave the situation, the violation was.
So you say you want to use
I wouldn't want to just say our judges should just, for gravity, just say this was grave.
No. But I think that what our judges do, I want to give them credit for this, is that typically what you get is you get a factual analysis, like in a fall protection case, where they're like, well, 12 feet off the ground, the inspector credibly testified that you could fall and suffer a skull fracture or a broken neck.
That's what I agree. They should say things like that.
They do look at the criteria, the gravity of the negligence. They explain kind of how much weight they're giving it, but, you know, factual analysis and like, oh, this
and
was
very
serious.
And then they assess their penalty. Lump them into the points.
They don't have to do point and gradation. Is it lost work days versus likely death? You know, they don't have to get that specific. And I wouldn't
ask them to do that either.
And I wouldn't ask myself. I would hope, like, I would sort of like to avoid, because I don't think
that,
it's appropriate for us to
figure that
out here.
With that understanding,
that's
what I
meant.
I can see the gradations between lost work days and permanently disabling and failing.
Are wanting that discussion?
Well, I'm seeing the point that Bill made about maybe, because I was sort of saying before, well, I'll just say it's serious.
You don't want them referencing the Part 100 regs. Right? I thought you said...
No, they don't have to.
I don't know. I mean, but in terms of... a broken hand is an S&S, but that's a lot different than a lost limb.
Right, yeah, right. And so for purposes of assessing a penalty, you know, you'd say, well, the gravity here was high. You know, it's you're coming up with a penalty. And, I mean, the S&S designation, I know it relates to the seriousness of the violation. That's a special finding, and it almost has a different purpose under the Act.
Right.
You know, it's allows certain right. enforcement actions to be taken. It
right.
triggers a timeline. MSHA
right.
comes back to the mind. You know, the pattern things. And, yeah, it's related to gravity. But then, but almost by the time they're being litigated before us, things like unwarrantable failure, the unwarrantable failure chain is, I mean, I don't know if there's still an unwarrantable failure chain. I mean, the point is about unwarrantable in terms of the enforcement approaches is puts you on the D chain, and they come back to your mind. Now you're getting withdrawal orders instead of citations. I mean, at this point, it's like, I don't know what it means to say take out the unwarrantable or leave it in. But what is pertinent is, well, except that they wanted a ruling. Mr. McHugh, the operator, said the way the judge approached this is problematical. I mean, I think he was overly worried. I don't think the judge's ruling could really be read that way. He was saying if you uphold this approach, any worker who seeks to correct a condition and gets exposed to a hazard in the meantime is, I don't know, all of their efforts to get thrown out the door. So that they wanted that cleared up, which our opinion would do, but
no, I don't think our opinion. Well, maybe, but the judge didn't get into that.
She didn't get. They
the
were
didn't
reading.
Didn't do what they said she did.
They said she did.
You're right about that. She said reasonably, and then switched to highly at the very late.
Well, that's also another thing. But let me ask on the gravity issue, considering that they were in waist high water. They were alone. The examiners were alone when they were doing this. They had no way of communicating out. Would you consider? I think that the judge's finding of reasonably likely to be fatal is affirmable on substantial evidence grounds.
No, okay, well, I mean, I disagree.
Yeah, I was going to say they disagree. I mean,
okay,
I know we have disagreement on that.
Okay.
So we may disagree. I mean, I'm not.
There is a potential for a fatal injury. I don't know that it. I don't want to get into it.
Yeah, I'm sort of lost track.
Because we have another order to discuss.
The recording order. And let's, maybe it'll sort of clarify. We can have a little post-mortem on this to try and sort out exactly how the opinion should be structured. But on the record-keeping violation, this will go in the same order.
I haven't given this as much thought as the other one by any means, and so I'm very interested in hearing your thoughts. But just going down the list and without much explanation, I'd say I would tend to sustain the high negligence, sustain the S&S, do something with the fatality thing because that's based off what I think was a mistake in the other one. And remand the unwarrantable failure so she could actually go through the facts, so that a judge could go through the factors rather than just incorporate whole cloth.
Oh, okay. Let's go just a farmer. Go ahead. Bob.
Okay. I would also affirm S&S in that the examiners had personally been exposed to the hazards of high water, and they did not list it, and Mr. Giovanelli countersigned it. This, to me, nullifies the ability of the report to have its safety-protecting effect, and I think the judge fully explained this, and I don't really have anything to add on it. I think the judge said something insightful in footnote 31. It is questionable if the respondent would have taken adequate measures to control the water conditions in the bleeder system, since no one deemed it enough of a hazard to record the problems. My view of the gravity here is just what we discussed before. I'm not going to go through that again. Negligence, I would affirm high negligence for the reasons that the judge stated in her opinion. As to unwarrantable, I think it has to be remanded. The judge felt that the factors were congruent with the ventilation plan factors, and I don't think they were. I think some of them were. The danger is the same analysis, probably. Knowledge is a different analysis, but clearly Stalnaker and Saunders and Givinelli and Price had knowledge. The extent is not an issue here, although it was an issue for the ventilation plan. I think the real reason why, without going into all of them, which I sort of made some notes on, but the thing that makes it necessary to remand it is that with regard to prior notice, clearly they had, CONSOL had prior notice with regard to the ventilation plan because of the two citations that Inspector Young had given a short time before. They were on notice that they had to do something better with regard to water in the bleeder system. And there were not any, to my knowledge, there were not any, and Inspector Young had talked to them specifically about that. But there wasn't anything comparable with regard to the recording violation. So if for no other reason, the recording violation needs to be analyzed on its own, and no, we should remand to do that. That's my view of it.
On the negligence, I would remand that. In addition to the facts that the judge cited in finding that it was high negligence, she also did credit the inspector's testimony. Look, this is a good miner, made an honest mistake, and that this was a mine that generally kept good books. I think an honest mistake is not necessarily a highly negligent act. So I would remand it to have that clarified. On the unwarrantable failure, I'd remand it along with everybody else for the reasons stated. I would find it S&S. On the gravity, it's the same gravity issue, and I would deal with it the same way we eventually decide to deal with the other one.
You know, I disagree with my colleagues. I think that I would affirm the judge. Drew, what is the penalty in this one?
Two of them. You're only disagreeing with me. They would affirm.
No,
they're making a remanding.
I thought you were saying negligence.
I'm affirming. I would just affirm.
Just straight affirm on everything.
Just affirm, because I'm going to ask my colleague, you know, from what I hear, I'm unclear why. Well, first of all, let me explain why I would affirm. To me, this is a situation where they had a form. They confronted. They couldn't complete their examination because they ran into the water. That's obviously a hazardous condition. There's a column on the form to note hazards. It was left blank. And not only did the examiner leave it blank, then the supervisor signed it with it blank, you know. And MSHA's enforcement action here, and the penalty assessed, I have no reason to throw that out, to vacate it and throw it out. And I'm hearing my colleagues, like, Bob, you said, no, it has to be vacated and remanded because they didn't discuss, like, the lack of notice. See, to me, it's getting to the point of these factors are becoming the controlling thing. Like, the judges have to, you know, you have to go through a certain language and checklist when it doesn't even make sense. why would you have to be told ahead of time, by the way, fill out a form correctly. Don't give a misimpression. Why would MSHA have to give you that prior notice? First of all, MSHA has a problem with even knowing when you've done it wrong, because unless they're there and see or have reason to know that there was something there and you left it out of the form, you know, and you didn't note it. I mean, that's sort of the problem, I think, part of the problem MSHA was indicating here. And so to say, judge, we're not upholding your decision, we're vacating it, we're sending it back to a new judge to have a whole new opinion where you go through this particular kind of checklist, like discussion of, duration. Is that relevant? Like, if you haven't filled out a form, how do I even think about duration?
It's not like she did an analysis and then short-stopped a couple things. She said, well, I'm just adopting my analysis from another violation. That's not congruent.
See, I don't think you
have
to go...
The analysis isn't congruent?
I don't think the analysis is even necessarily...
You have
fitting
you,
here. It's like
she has to do an analysis. We can look at it and say, well, she did an analysis, but she didn't discuss three irrelevant factors. We're not going to ding her for that. She didn't discuss any factors. She said, look at what I said about the other violation that's completely different than this violation in terms of the all of the facts.
The record, I guess to me, I'm looking at it, it would never be anything other than, you know, an unwarrantable violation here with... I think I consider it serious because when you leave things off a form, you don't indicate hazards. That's serious. People go into the mine. The whole, you know, point of these examination reports, you have to denote the hazards. People have to know what they're getting into. And here, you have the management person going along with it. I don't see how, even if you thought it was a mistake by the lower person that they thought, oh, I don't have to put the hazard that prevented me from completing the exam on the form until I actually complete the exam, you know, when it's kind of a moot question. That doesn't even make any sense. And if that's what they really thought, then there's still a lot of negligence on the management people for not training those people the right way to know that you fill out a form where there's a column that says hazards and you encounter a hazard, you have to put in the hazard. And so it's just like, it's a knowing violation. They knew they weren't putting in the hazard. So I would ask my colleagues to just think about possibly affirming this judge's decision.
We've held that this unwarrantable consideration is inherently a judicial function, that it's a balancing, that it's kind of an art. And it just wasn't done here. And if they take this to the Court of Appeals, what are they going to look at? We have to basically put together an analysis and accomplish the mixed fact law finding that the judge goes through, because it wasn't done here. You can't allow her, I think it was an error, it's a clear error, to allow her to borrow from the other unwarrantable failure application, because the actions are just completely different. I don't necessarily disagree with you. In fact, I don't think I do disagree with you. I mean, it was like I said at oral argument yesterday, if we applied the Iowa Coal factors, I think it's worse for you on this violation than it was on the other one, because, yeah, you've got the foreman involved. You know that you didn't list the hazards on here.
Well, then let me ask
you. Maybe there's explanation as to why that was done, but it is serious because this is the record.
So would a record allow findings other than what are here? I mean, because in that case, if you in your mind thought, this is worse for you, I mean, this is an unwarrantable violation with S&S, an unwarrantable, negligent, why would it be remanded? You know, because you would reverse it. If somebody came back and said on remand, I don't find it unwarrantable or S&S,
For the same reason that I'm on the fence on the other one and saying we should remand that one too, even though I don't think it's an unwarrantable failure, I would think we should remand this one even though I think it is an unwarrantable failure, because, yes, I think that you could look at the evidence in this case and say you had these two examiners, things were kind of screwed up, there was a coordination problem and an issue there.
I'm not following. What was the coordination problem on the form?
Him not being able to get there and talking about, I write things down when I get back up because it's hard to write them when you're down there. So I tend to write these things down when I get back up to the surface. I'm not going to let this govern my decision making, but my belief is that Giovanelli signed this thing because he was there and they wanted to get his signature while they had him, and they wanted to get this taken care of and were committed to doing that, and it didn't happen. And they screwed it up. Is it unwarrantable? Probably. But is it necessarily unwarrantable beyond any argument? There's no analysis for me to say, well, the judge put enough on this for us to know. That means we have to do it. And that means, as a matter of law, we have to basically do a summary decision on this. If you make the case for me, I'll consider it. I will consider it. I'll listen to you. But I think that this is something the judge is supposed to do, and it wasn't done.
So it's just kind of making the judge sort of punishing you.
She's not even there. I don't care, but I'm not trying to punish the judge. I'm just trying to have the system work the way it's supposed to function. Exactly.
Of the office of judges to do the fact finding and analysis. That's not punishment.
Okay, fact finding and analysis is fine. To have a sort of straitjacket analysis and language that, in my mind, doesn't even apply in some cases. And to just say, oh, they didn't, IO factor, it wasn't. And this is more than this case. I'll just sort of alert you to this, like, opinions that's becoming more difficult for me to sign on to of certain languages in it, which makes it sound like you must go through this, you must consider each of these factors. And sometimes it's sort of
that's
absurd.
Not even what I'm saying, Mary Lou, but and I don't mean
to
say
I'm not saying here,
to the
I'm
judge.
Just kind of like
but
throwing that out in general.
What she said was not coherent legally, because she directed us to look at something that doesn't apply to this violation. The conduct is so completely different that I don't see how you can say, just look at what I said on the other violation and apply it here. I don't get that. It doesn't make sense to me. But like I said, if you can make it make sense to me, I'll consider it.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm not saying that necessarily made sense or appropriate. I'm looking at it more just generic of when a case comes before me where there's not a dispute, they did not fill out the examination form. I mean, knowing violation, that was sort of a standard kind of unwarrantable type case that often came up before the commission. Here it's just like, anyway, I've said my piece. So I just didn't think this warranted vacating her decision and sending it back to her.
If there's a case that says, look, there's knowing violation, unwarrantable failure every time. If you've got authority that says that, I'll buy onto it.
I mean, frankly, falsifying records can even be wind up to be criminal prosecution under the Mine Act. So, I mean, it's usually considered.
I think if one were to take this as a criminal matter, one would be very
hard to
prosecute Consall or Mr. Giovanelli or anybody else.
I'm just saying that would not fly. Is it really impossible to consider, you know, just affirming this decision given that I think it meets, you know, the unwarrantable, the penalty seems
I'll throw it 2 cents and say, I think, in a sense, the most interesting damning or not damning part of it is that water was never listed as a hazard, which I don't think they were doing, like, intentionally not putting down a hazard. He didn't consider it a hazard.
Which
Saunders
is
went
part
walking
of the problem
through,
too?
Through the water,
yeah,
and he did
not
consider it a hazard.
It's not a hazard.
Which would speak to
the other
all we've talked about a lot today. Yeah,
exactly.
But,
yeah.
You know, in essence, when has MSHA ever said how deep water has to be a hazard? 18 inches is not a hazard at all.
You know, but, I mean, if you can't make your exam, I mean, the point of this you can't make the readings because the water's too high.
No, no. I mean, you would think...
At some point there's a hazard.
Did I encounter any hazards on that exam? Yeah, I think it's the water.
I think this is one of those things where we have evolved in mindset. So my guess is that for many, many years in bleeder sections, guys have been wading through a lot of water. And so if you're an old-time miner, you don't think going up to your waist in water. Green said, if you had 42 inches of water and defective pump, you go get a new pump. You said, hell no, I go over and just fix the pump.
And I'm carrying it on my back.
I don't think they were criminal in not putting down what they perceived as hazards. Saunders never in his mind that he was in a hazard.
I don't know.
It's an argument. I mean, make an argument. Like I said, I'll consider it.
So where are we on this now? For Drupa said,
well, I think we've got different opinions on this.
So I would just affirm, but so my opinion would be short. Confirm.
Just a little bit off your nose.
Remanding on negligence was the other three of us would affirm on it. So I think we've got different views on this. We'll probably have multiple opinions.
Who's remaining on negligence? Oh, you're remaining on negligence. Yes. That's right. I'm sure.
Yeah.
And you and Bob are remanding on
unwarrantable failure.
I'll say this. If you can convince me that this is a clear known violation and that it has to be unwarrantable, I think I would have to say, well, then it's high negligence.
You know, I think what would be useful here is
nowhere bigger than that.
And I'm thinking of something that Sarah Stewart, I don't know if Sarah's here, did on one of those cases that we had prior to August 30th, is that she put together an outline of a decision and then we commented on it.
That's a good idea.
And I think I would suggest that Druba do that, and then we can give feedback to him and see where we go from there. Okay.
That's a good idea.
Hey, something I want to say. We've just been here for almost 2 hours conducting the public business in public with four commissioners from different parties, none of whom agreed with anyone else on everything. And we did it courteously, listening to each other, changing our positions. And it strikes me at the end of this 18-month horror show of a presidential campaign that if more government were conducted a little bit more this way rather than the way they're doing it out there with all their paid consultants and billions of dollars floating around, maybe the people in this country would respect the government more. But they have no respect for the government now. And it's really sad because it is possible to conduct government
Can I say something tangential to that, which is
a way that could support Republican values?
I wasn't a big fan of us sitting down at the table here at first. It seemed kind of cramped, but I do want to thank Commissioner Nackmer former Chairman Nackmer for coming up with the idea, because we're having real discussions now, and we didn't necessarily always used to do that. So. And I think it's helpful. It's been helpful.
Yeah, I agree. All right, well, we'll go off the record.